Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're going to be talking with Steve Gerlach. He's back. He's a shareholder with Bernstein Sure. We're going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act. We're going to be talking about ESOPs. We're going to have a great time. And Steve may even sing. Steve, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you.
Hey, good morning. Well, you know, as I know you're so excited and passionate about the Affordable Care Act, I figured we would kick right off with, you know, now, audience, please stay with me. Okay, we got a whole show, but we're going to kick it off with Affordable Care Act. What are some of the updates that's going on with that?
The big news on the ACA, Dave, is that employers have started receiving these notices from the marketplace, the healthcare marketplaces. And they're pretty much a form notice, but there's a piece of cocktail party advice that I like to give with respect to these. And it's really just hypothetical because us tax attorneys we don't get invited to cocktail parties. But nonetheless, nonetheless, there's sort of a basic idea. If you receive a notice from a government agency, don't ignore it. And that these marketplace notices are no different than that. If you're an employer and you've received one of these marketplace notices, take a few minutes, sit down, and read it. Okay? They all say roughly the same thing. Your employee X has qualified for a tax credit on the marketplace because one of two or three things, but essentially because you, employer, didn't offer that person affordable health coverage. And many times, that's going to be okay. There's going to be a reason why you didn't offer them affordable health coverage. They're not full-time. They no longer work for you. A number of different reasons. However, on occasion, believe it or not, the marketplaces get it wrong. And that's the thing you need to pay attention to, because there's a limited window in which you can file an appeal on the marketplace. And I want you to think of this marketplace notice as the very small snowball at the top of the hill. And what you want to do is you want to stop that snowball before it starts rolling and gets down and turns into a giant snow boulder at the bottom. To draw that out a little bit, the exchange notice, if you let that go by, then the determination made by the marketplace essentially stands. And it says this person qualifies for tax credit and you may be penalized for that. So the thing to do is, if that information is incorrect, if that person was full-time, if you offered them coverage and that coverage was affordable, then you need to appeal it. And you need to work with someone, an expert in the field, that knows how to structure the evidence to appeal that. And you need to respond within the time allotted on the notice itself.
So, you know, we've talked about this being, you know, hey, even the thought of them getting it wrong, it happens, right? I mean, it's a reality, is it? So what type of fines are we talking about if right now employers get these notices? What's the scope of that?
Sure. And there's, you know, many of us who've been working in this field have been saying literally for years now, that there's going to be this transition period where the information going in is not going to be accurate, or it's not going to be 100% accurate. There's going to be mistakes made. And when you think about it, the reason for that is the sort of beginning of that process is that the employee sits down at their computer and they go to the marketplace online and they answer a bunch of questions. And maybe they get the answers to the questions right, and maybe they don't. One of those questions is, has your employer offered you affordable coverage? The employee doesn't know what affordability means under the Affordable Care Act. And so they answer it according to their own instincts, unless they've taken the time to read the notices that the employer has sent out and so forth. And sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So there's going to be mistakes made is the bottom line with it. The penalties are those employer mandate penalties that folks have been talking about for years now. There's two different buckets of penalties. There's the big bad one, the $2,000 bucket, in which if the employer is failing to offer coverage to at least 95% of its full-time employees, then you're hit for a penalty of $2,080 now per full-timer. Calculations are a little more nuanced than that, but that's the big picture on it. There's also the affordability penalty. The affordability penalty is a lesser penalty, even though the number is higher. It's $3,120 per employee, but it's only per employee affected on that one. So there's a bunch of money at stake, it's better to stop that snowball at the top of the hill than to let it roll.
No, absolutely. I mean, certainly the bottom line is at this point, it's the law of the land, and it's what we need to do in regards to understanding that we have to follow the rules that go in there.
Yeah.
Are there any changes coming up that you're aware of, even maybe for 2017 or the beginning of 2017, having to do with things like the Cadillac tax or things like the change from 100 employees to 50 employees, or any adjustments coming down the pike that you're aware of?
That I'm aware of, the Cadillac tax is still being discussed. It's been postponed to 2020 now. If I were to pull out my crystal ball, I'd give it a 50-50 chance of surviving until 2020. It's a pay-for provision that doesn't really, in my view, meet with the public policy ideas behind the law, taxing folks because they're offering a rich health plan to their employees. The other issue that's coming down the pike, one that I continue to see, is employers wanting to do kind of a defined contribution. I want to pay X towards each of my employees' health coverage, and then they can go out and get their own individual coverage. And generally speaking, that's illegal. And there are a couple of exceptions. The private exchanges are starting to pop up, even in the small group areas now. That type of defined contribution can work in the context of a private exchange, but this is not something that an employer should go into and just say, oh, we're going to do this. And they need to really be thoughtful about it and engage folks who are familiar with the ACA rules.
So a lot of the one of the things that I know that people are looking at is self-funding, right? And so self-funding for their health insurance. Is there anything new in that aspect of law currently today?
In self-funding, the roadmap of laws is a little bit different in self-funding, where federal law applies to them, but state insurance law generally doesn't, except to the extent that there's a stop loss or reinsurance policy in place to cover the high claims. I'm seeing a lot of activity in the self-funded space and different ways to structure it, and folks looking at captive insurers as a way to mitigate some risk. And the market's really innovating right now. A lot of pressure on the market and a lot of response from it. And I believe that the folks who are administering self-funded plans have gotten better at it over the years, and that the numbers are more robust so that you can see smaller groups looking at self-funding. You can see groups in the 50s and 60s and 70 employee counts using self-funded plans. There's a bit of a trick to get into it, in terms of the claims. You want to try not to get into it in a high claims year, but a lot of folks are looking at it seriously.
No, I mean, they're looking at it because they're looking at cost, right? I mean, one of the big challenges, and look, we even face it as a small company ourselves, is that, you know, this year, I think it was medical insurance went up double digit in terms of overall increases. And most companies that I speak to, they are seeing double digit increases. And you know, brokers are talking about it again being potential double digit next year. In terms of the next or later this year, in terms of the rates, are you seeing anything on the cost side from a pressure perspective, or what you're hearing from clients?
Sure, there's a few different ways to get at the cost issue. One is with plan design. And that's so we take it. There's plan design. There's the funding method, which gets to the self-insured. And those two have a bit of an interplay between it. So what I mean is there employers that are looking at plan design are looking at things like engaging employees' ability to choose in the marketplace, ability to choose their health care and make sensible decisions, the consumer-driven approach to it. And that's generally done with a high deductible plan and some possible contribution to either a health savings account or a health reimbursement arrangement. And in either event, that money becomes the money for the employee to spend down, and it engages their buying power and their makes them feel the cost of the health services that they are purchasing. Those types of arrangements have been around a while now, and they're becoming more and more popular, and I think that's because they work to a certain degree. They're not. Are they going to mitigate the double digit? Yeah, they're going to mitigate, but they're not going to eliminate that double digit growth in cost. The funding, as we talked about, the self-insured, what it does is it takes you out of the group marketplace and into your own group. The advantage of it is you're not dealing with the insurer except with the extent that you have stop-loss coverage.
Yeah, catastrophic coverage. Yeah.
Catastrophic coverage, exactly. But you're not dealing with the group marketplace. You have more flexibility over plan design, and you have more flexibility over cost controls, including doing things like wellness programs and so forth that help bring your claims experience down. And folks are having some success with that. Again, medical inflation is higher than regular inflation is, and it's going to have some effect. And we're kind of whittling away with it at it with plan design and with funding design. That second step along that self-insured process, you see folks looking at captives. Do you know the main sense captive is no longer? But it was a valiant attempt. I'll put it that way. And there are captives operating either from other states. You see them from Tennessee or Vermont. And I've seen one captive that actually operates out of Bermuda. And the captive is essentially, if you look at it, you've got the typical design I see is you have a bunch of self-insured employers who then they gather together and they share risk. A tranche of risk or a bucket of risk, if you will, at a little bit higher level before they engage that stop loss. And then oftentimes they'll use their collective buying power to purchase stop loss insurance at lower premiums as well. So that one's out there. And then we mentioned the private exchanges as a possibility for just defining what the contribution is to the health plan.
Is there a benefit for employers to fund or help fund HSA accounts? In other words, from a tax perspective, obviously health savings accounts or employees have the ability to sock money away, but I have seen some employers talking about funding some of those with dollars. Is there a tax benefit to that from an HR perspective?
Yeah, the employer gets a deduction for that. For that expenditure, if you will. So let's say employer puts $500 into the employee's HSA. That's considered a compensation deduction, so it comes off of the corporate income. And then that money is not subject to the usual withholding taxes, meaning the income tax withholdings, and importantly for the employer, the FICA tax. And so there is a FICA tax benefit to that. The employer doesn't have to do their contribution to that piece of it as well. So the important thing, I think, with HSAs or any of these vehicles is to look at the tax piece of it in the context of the whole and not let the tax tail wag the dog. Meaning, if we're getting that overall lower experience, getting that overall lower premium, that overall lower health plan costs, including perhaps a component that has a tax cost. That's the goal. Oftentimes you'll see people going after, but I've saved this much in taxes. Well, that's not the entire goal. You want to save overall.
We're talking with Steve Gerlach from Bernstein Sure. He's a shareholder there. We've been talking about the Affordable Care Act update. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, presented by cmacareer.com and main.dalecarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's a shareholder with the law firm Bernstein Shore right here in Portland, Maine. But of course, your firm does a lot more than just Maine. You're across the country, correct?
Certainly regionally, yeah. We have a presence in New Hampshire and Maine, and we do work in Massachusetts, New York. Yeah.
Great, great. Well, you know, I was on your website page here, Steve, and it says, I quote, "Meet Steve, Affordable Care Act pro and musician."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the musician part, Steve.
That's a very long story, Dave. So we'll give you the short version.
Yay!
Before...
yeah, typical attorney answer, ladies and gentlemen. That's a long version. Can we get the, you know, like the short, really condensed version? Yes.
The snapshot version. Yes. Sure. I played in rock bands through late 80s and early 90s throughout... started off in northern Maine, up in Orono and Bangor area, and then moved down to Portland and did
instrument,
some touring.
You,
yeah, I in it, most of the time I played bass and sang backup vocals in my one band, the name of which was Pluck Theater. If anyone there, you occasionally see a Pluck Theater disc out there in the used bins.
Nice.
But I've also done the singer-songwriter thing, acoustic guitar and vocals, you know, just depends on the context. Had a lot of fun, traveled around a bit, didn't make a dime. And currently these days I sing with a local Renaissance choir, quite a little bit different turn on things, but a local called Renaissance Voices, and been with them for about 16 years now.
Well, good for you.
Yeah.
So maybe for the last segment, we'll have you sing something. Now we're going to move on to the next subject. The next subject that we're going to talk about is ESOPs. And for those who don't know what an ESOP is, it's an employee stock ownership plan. You know, this has become more and more popular over the last number of years, where you have organizations that are literally taking employee stock ownership plans as a retirement plan for maybe the owner, mm-hmm. or maybe they want to grow the organization and get more ownership and more employee engagement of the employees. Let's start at the basics, all right? So if you could define it for us a little bit more than obviously just what it is.
Sure.
And then maybe we can talk about how somebody might go about doing this, why they might consider doing it, what are the ramifications for doing it, you know, all that whole aspects of it. And you have a couple minutes, Steve. I'm sure we can get through this.
Absolutely. And should I be singing this or should we just
No,
talk?
No, we're going to wait for the last segment. Oh, okay. We're going to wait for the last segment
just,
on
know,
that.
Singing
will be great. Everybody can wait for that.
Yeah.
And we'll get that right. Maybe you can sing the Bernstein Sure theme song.
Maybe I could. I was looking forward to the ESOP opera myself.
ESOP opera.
Okay, so ESOPs, you know, 20,000 feet, and ESOP is it's a retirement plan. It's like a 401k. It's a tax qualified retirement plan. The rules are a bit different with a 401k, but from 20,000 feet, money goes in pre tax and doesn't. And is not taxed until an employee pulls it out, usually upon retirement. The difference is that an ESOP plan holds is designed to hold employer stock rather than mutual funds. And the importance of that is that it has become, is designed to be, and has become a very useful tool for private companies to transition out of their current ownership and into a more employee ownership situation. The general way that it works is that there's a sale transaction, just like any other sale in many respects, in which the owner or owners of the company sell all or a portion of their shares to this specially designed retirement plan. Sometimes there's a bank loan involved in that to finance the transaction. Sometimes the owners finance. Number of tax benefits, depending on how things are, on how the corporations are designed. S corporations, for example, to the extent that an S corporation is owned by the ESOP, it does not have taxable income. If the ESOP owns a C corporation, that doesn't stay true because there is corporate level tax there. However, the owner does have tax benefits on the backside, where if they follow certain rules, they're not taxed until they actually draw the proceeds out of their. It's called qualified replacement property. Basically, it's been a rollover for them. So that's you know, from 20,000 feet, that's how they work. The reason I think that they've become very popular in recent years is driven by demographics. There's a lot of business owners that are reaching retirement age, have been reaching, will be reaching over the next 10, 15 years or so, and they're looking for transition plans. And oftentimes they're looking for a transition plan that meets what they want to do or what they want for their employees. I've worked with now ESOP-owned companies, for example, that were built by, you know, a couple of people over 20, 25, 30 years, and they've got this group of employees that are like family to them. And they have the option of perhaps going to market and selling to some big third-party company, out of state, that kind of thing. And they could walk away with a good-sized check from doing so. But they feel protective towards their employees. They want the business to continue profitably, yes, but more or less to keep those folks in place. And there's worries that a big company would come in and lay everybody off and restructure everything. Oftentimes an ESOP is used as a solution where there isn't a market, where we've been seeing a lot of action in the construction industry because a lot of times there's not a big third-party buyer out there that wants to come in and buy a local construction company or a local contractor. So we've been seeing a lot of activity in those spaces as well. There's the marketplace has gotten better at doing ESOPs. I think there's a deeper understanding than there might have been even 5 years ago about how they work. Again, I think driven by demand, people looking at it, yeah.
Again, we're talking with Steve Gerlach, shareholder at Bernstein Sure. One of the things ESOP questions always come up is, how do they work for an employee that maybe works there but then leaves? Is it just like a retirement plan? You take that money with you? How does that work?
There's a short version and a long version to that answer. The short version is more or less, yeah. The long version is that, especially if you're dealing with a leveraged ESOP, so an ESOP in which there's been a bank loan to finance the purchase of the shares, those shares aren't worth a whole lot in the beginning. So if an employee leaves shortly after the ESOP is adopted, a lot of times those shares aren't worth a whole lot. And that it takes time for that, for the company to grow into the ESOP. As the debt gets paid down, those shares become worth more, and the ESOP becomes worth more. The company becomes worth more. So there's a timing element to it. The little bit longer version of it is that there's usually a right of the employee to sell his or her shares. They get a distribution from the ESOP, and there's a right to sell the shares back to the company. 99% of the time, that's what they do. Sometimes you'll see a right of the company to buy those shares from the employees so that the ownership doesn't get too scattered out there.
So leadership uses this sometimes as a, and it's part of a compensation incentive plan sometimes in terms of using this. Are there benefits to looking at that in terms of from a tax structure for the company itself?
More so for an S corporation than for a C corporation. As you know, Dave, S corporations are one level of tax. It's a flow through entity, and only the owners are taxed, generally speaking. As C corporation, there's two levels of taxation, both the corporation itself and the owners are taxed on the income. Very big picture. That plays out in the ESOP in the sense that when the ESOP, which is a non-taxable entity, it's like I said, like a 401k plan, when the ESOP owns a company 100%, if that's an S corporation, all of the profits and losses are flowing up into this nonprofit entity, and it essentially becomes non-taxable. In the C corp situation, it's still taxed at the corporate level.
So if an organization is thinking about doing this and saying, you know, what's the benefit for my employee? What's the benefit for the owner? Obviously, they would work through the pros and cons of doing this, no question. I assume that the ESOP has a board that actually is in charge of the company, selects a leadership team, and that board then gets overseen by the owner?
So sometimes in the transition, that's what happens. So there's a couple of different things I'd like to address in that. So the first one being the ESOP as an incentive. That has components of it that have to do with deciding whether to do an ESOP and then what happens as a result of the ESOP. One of the things, the common wisdom about an ESOP is that you want to look for in the company a certain ownership culture. Is the company ripe? Are there people there who are going to lead this company? And are they willing to take ownership of it? Not just, you know, actual ownership of the company, but act as an owner. And that's one of the cultural things that you look for. That's also something that can be grown into. And working with many owners who they identify their sort of team that they want, and they know that they're not there yet. They know that they're not owners yet, but they take the period. You know, many of these owners won't retire immediately after the sale.
Of course,
you know they'll work for 7 or 10 years or something like that after, and they'll work that transition, and they'll gradually get their leadership team in place so that by the time they're ready to step down, the company can operate without them. So there's a cultural aspect to that. Once the ESOP's in place, then there's this. Then there is an incentive effect. There's an ownership effect, I think, for employees that are paying attention to that. It's like, hey, I own a piece of the company. That's cool, right? And then they see the value of that piece of the company growing over time and how it's related to what they do. And that's really cool. That's the incentive piece of it. If they see the value of the company going up, those loans being paid down, their share getting bigger, it's a direct result of their actions and the actions that they take with the rest of the company. So a terrific incentive. Sometimes you'll see an ESOP teamed up with other incentive programs to make everything kind of play nice in the sandbox together. But, yeah, it's a terrific incentive that way.
So for an owner that really looks at this and says, okay, I'm considering an ESOP and I'm considering a sale, okay, one of the two. And so you gave the statement that for them an employee perspective, it can drive employee engagement. It can drive them feeling like more part of ownership of the organization. from a tax perspective, from a legal tax perspective, is there a benefit to doing one over the other?
Generally speaking, there's going to be a tax benefit. There's more of a tax benefit to the ESOP. But that kind of gets back to the question of taking that tax benefit in the context of the whole. For example, if you can justify an ESOP sale of $5 million based on current valuations and so forth, and you get a tax benefit that makes that $5 million actually worth $5 million as opposed to $3.5 million, something like that, and then someone comes along and offers you $10 million for the company, take the $10 million. At least if you're just looking at the numbers, because the tax benefit is outweighed by the purchase price. Other reasons, as we've talked about, to go with the ESOP have to do with kind of the legacy piece of it, the owner wanting their business to continue in the form that it has been. Maybe they don't have that son or daughter who's ready to step in and take over the company at that level. And so they're looking for other ways to do that.
The other question I'd have on that is, are there state regulations that if you have a company that has locations in Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, are there changes within that ownership requirements based on any state regulation between the states having to do with ESOPs?
I would say a little bit. So what I mean by that is that the ESOP is an owner of a company. And all of that tax machinery that's built inside of the ESOP is all driven by federal law. However, it's still owner of a company, and you have to follow the corporate rules of the state you're in order to make sure that you know, whatever, you have bylaws that meet the rules in various states and so on and so forth. So, yes, it's not a primary driver because a lot of the corporate laws are similar to each other from state to state, but it's... You know, there are I's that need to be dotted.
We're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's a shareholder at the law firm of Bernstein Scher. We've been talking about the Affordable Care Act and now ESOPs. And you've been listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM. And presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today, we're talking with the one, the only, Steve Gerlach, attorney, shareholder at Bernstein Scher. We've been talking about ESOPs. You know, in the last segment, Steve, we kind of talked about a lot of the reasons why and kind of what an ESOP is and how that all goes about. But there are risks to doing an ESOP. So what are some of the downsides that, you know, HR professionals, business leaders really think about before they make that type of decision?
Sure. One of the main ones is cost. ESOPs are expensive. They're complicated. And it's not something to go into lightly. Many of the business owners that I know who eventually decide on an ESOP, they've been studying it for months or even a couple of years before they decide to take the dive. And it's because they are complicated beasts. And there's and they can become even hugely complicated. You know, if somebody wants a particular design on their ESOP, you can combine them with a 401k plan, for example, and further complicate things. And there needs to be an appetite for complexity. There needs to be an appetite. There are a number of service providers that become involved that a business may not have had to deal with before, including third-party administrators, including actuaries. There has to be an annual valuation of the company for the ESOP purposes. There are a number of costs and complexities with it that they're not necessarily a reason not to do it, but they're definitely on the page. They're something that need to be considered. You had asked earlier about the leadership structure once an ESOP's in place. So the way that's usually done is that there's the ESOP, like any other retirement, you know, qualified retirement plan, is a trust. And so it's governed by trustees. And it's usually a committee comprised of employees, leadership in the company. Sometimes there's an independent third party who's also a trustee, like someone from a bank, for example, something like that. There's a new level of responsibility when you are a trustee of an ESOP, because you become a fiduciary to the ESOP and you have to manage the ESOP affairs in the best interest of the participants in the ESOP. And sometimes that can be, it requires an employee or an executive at a company to change hats and stop thinking like an employee and start thinking like a fiduciary. And you know, that's where folks can get into trouble. I think especially early on in the transactional phases and shortly thereafter, when folks are not used to that changing hats like that, there can be some mistakes made. And we see cases come down the pike that where there's been violations of fiduciary duty based on various issues such as valuation, for example.
Well, it's always different when you have an owner or owners that mm-hmm. are working in the best interest of the company, always. But they make decisions sometimes based upon their interest. And when you're talking about having fiduciary responsibility, suddenly it's collective interest, right? And that is a different mindset if you're not thinking that way consistently in terms of the process.
Absolutely. If you think about it, if we take a snapshot of the ESOP transaction itself, where the owner is selling his or her shares to the ESOP, that owner might also be sitting on the ESOP trustee committee. So that means that owner is on both sides of the transaction. As owner, that owner wants the highest price possible they can get for their shares. But as the buyer sitting on the ESOP committee, they want the lowest price shares. That reason right there is why it's best practice. It's at this point, it's industry standard that there is an independent appraisal done of the company based on that particular transaction and the timing of it and how many shares are sold.
Well, that would make sense, because I don't think you could have an unbiased opinion at that point based upon having that type of conflict. And that serves no interest, really, in across the board to make that happen. And then, of course, both sides have to agree upon that, I'm sure, in terms of an independent role.
Right.
What are the negatives are you aware of that, you know, organizations need to think about before they do this?
Sure. So let's say that we've gotten through the ESOP transaction and we're 5 years down the road. Well, okay. We're 5 years down the road now, or 10 years down the road, and the ESOP is maturing. One of the things that can happen is that the ESOP can become unbalanced, because the contributions are often made on a percentage of compensation, and the more highly compensated are going to have bigger accounts. Well, there's rules about favoring highly compensated employees, and you have to pull in such techniques as rebalancing to ensure that there's a bit more of a level playing field. It's not a 100%, but a bit more of a level playing field. There's ongoing duties like that to adjust the accounts in the plan. And sometimes you will see someone who's got a very large account in the plan, oh, that person's retired. So now there's two ways to deal with that, with cashing out that account. Either the ESOP does it or the company does it. And sometimes that can be a bunch of money. Sometimes that requires separate financing in and of itself. But those ongoing redemption requirements can be an important cost in the future.
Sure, and they could be called at times that may not be the best for the organization, right? They could be, they retired, they need that income, and now maybe it's a slower time of year. Maybe it's a slower year in
right.
general.
Right.
And I'm sure there's a balance between that somewhere in the plan, but
right.
but the reality is that, you know, that has to be paid out.
Right. Right. And you know, circling back to the construction industry, very cyclical. And, you know, you try as best you can when you're going into it to think about those cycles and what the demands of cash flow are going to be well into the future, but nobody has a crystal ball on that. And if there's another big dip in construction work a few years out, you may not have the cash flow to cash somebody out.
So let's talk about the worst case scenario. Company goes belly up. Mm-hmm. Something happens.
Right.
You know, there's a hierarchy in terms of what we call payouts mm-hmm. Of what's being paid out. Does this have a benefit for employees to be part of an ESOP? Or is there less of a benefit for that aspect?
Sure. Well, if we compare having an ESOP account, let's just pick a number, $50,000.
Sure.
If we compare having a $50,000 ESOP account to having been paid that $50,000 in wages over time, the ESOP account is protected. It's in a trust, and that trust can only be administered for the benefit of the participants in that trust. Generally speaking, you can't get at qualified retirement plan money in bankruptcy. There have been exceptions to that where the bankruptcy court has ordered it, but they're very rare. So there's some extra protection there for the employee. There's also the sort of forced savings piece of it. It's, you've got $50,000 in retirement that you wouldn't otherwise have. And that may not have worked in the context of a 401k plan. You may not have been able to get that same level of savings out of it. So a couple of ways it benefits.
Okay. We're talking with Steve Gerlach, shareholder at Bernstein Sure. We've been talking about ESOPs. Any other information that you feel that you want to provide to the audience, whether it's plus or minus having to do with ESOPs, and then, of course, you know, maybe what your recommendation is for a company to, if they're thinking about doing it, how to start?
Sure. I think we've more or less covered the pluses and minuses. The where to start, there's a number of places to start. There are some good primers out there. Some people call it primer. I don't know. A good place to start is the ESOP Association. Just go online and enter it in. The ESOP Association is actually having its Northeast Conference at Sable Oaks in October of this year. So if you're a company out there, you're thinking about ESOP, that's a really good place to start, is just go to that conference and gather some information. Go online, try to find some accounts of companies. You know, look for those owner accounts. Look for an owner telling their story. And you'll also find that, again, at the ESOP Association conference, is that there will be owners there who have done ESOPs and are willing to tell their stories about it. I think those are the two main things. And then if you kind of get through that piece of it, then the next piece, drill down. You think you want to do an ESOP. The next step is probably to start engaging some of the professionals that you're going to need. You're going to need legal counsel, and you're going to need an accounting firm that can do a feasibility study. And the feasibility study is a really important piece early in the process, because it's as close as we can get to that crystal ball It takes a look at the company's current assets and liabilities and cash flow, projects out into the future. They're, you know, generally speaking, you take a very conservative view of what's going to happen in the future and projects out, okay, can we do this? Can we keep up with the required contributions? What's it going to, what kind of pressure will it put on the company? You know, sometimes the answer comes back. It's like, not really. You really can't do it for whatever reason. Too leveraged, too much of a debt load right now. Come back in 5 years and look, think about it again, that kind of thing. Or more often what you see is some guidance about how to structure it, how to do it. But that first step of the feasibility study is very, very helpful in doing that. And then just be aware it takes time and it's not a cheap adventure.
We're talking with Steve Gerlach, shareholder, Bernstein Scherer, here in Portland, Maine, covering the Northeast as they do. And we've been talking about ESOPs, pluses, minuses, and now we just talked about what to do if you're really serious about it. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we've been talking with Steve Gerlach. He's a shareholder with the law firm Bernstein Scherer in Portland, Maine, and of course they cover the whole Northeast. We've been talking about ESOPs primarily, mm-hmm. but also been talking about the Affordable Care Act, and we've been talking about the fact that Steve's a fantastic singer and a fantastic bass player, and unfortunately didn't bring his bass today, or we would have absolutely had him play today, and I'm not going to make him sing on air, though, because he looks like he's scared. So we won't do that today. We won't make that happen, but we are going to have some fun with him because he's a good friend, so I can do that. It also says in your formal life, you are a manager of a chain restaurant. Mm-hmm. On your bike. What chain?
Ponderosa Steakhouse.
You know what? They're still in existence.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I saw one in New York. I must have been a few months ago. Yeah. I didn't even, but they used to be around here, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's like Bonanza, another chain that hasn't been out there for years. What you learn as a retail manager?
Holy smokes. It was a long time ago. So what I learned, okay, patience. That was a big thing. Patience. The reason that I say that is that you get into a Saturday night and there are 300 people waiting in line and everyone is hungry and they want to eat. And
that's called hangry.
Hangry.
Right?
Exactly. Hangry, yeah. And you just, there's nothing for it. You can't dodge it. You just have to go out there and talk to them and maybe hand out cheese slices or something to keep them from melting down. But yeah, patience.
And that patience obviously has served you well as an attorney, right? I mean, one of the things you do is have to listen to a lot of people bring issues to you. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, talk to us a little bit about, as we wrap the show up today, why you became an attorney and why you enjoy it so much.
Sure. That is another very long tale. If you had asked me 20 years ago or told me that, Steve, you're going to become a tax attorney, I would have said, No, I'm not. But after I did the music thing full time for a while, in the late 90s, I started working at Maine Medical Center, and I was coordinating research for the anesthesia department. And there was a lot of legal compliance stuff with that, including HIPAA was just being rolled out. There was also informed consent and other issues. And the docs that I was running the studies for were just like, it's all yours, bud. Have fun. And so I started working on legal compliance, and that was when I got the inkling that I might like to go to law school. And here we are, almost 20 years later.
Doesn't seem possible, does it?
It didn't then.
Understand. Well, Steve, I want to thank you very much for coming in, giving us an Affordable Care Act update, talking a little bit about ESOPs, you know, the value, the benefits, and the challenges that go along with that. You know, certainly we'll continue to ask you back to the show. Appreciate you joining us, and hope you have a wonderful rest of the weekend.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB at 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Tani Alvarez. In many industries where employees have fluctuating schedules, in which some weeks employees will be called upon to work 30 hours a week and in others 50 hours a week, employers ask if they may offer employees a comp time system in which the employee earns time off as opposed to overtime wages for hours worked in excess of 40 in a week. Under federal law, employees are entitled to wages at a rate of time and a half for all hours worked in excess of 40. The FLSA does not contemplate a comp time system. While employees in certain jurisdictions may increase the number of hours they work one day in order to take time off on another day in the same week, if the employee works over 40 hours in any one week, he or she would be entitled to overtime at a rate of time and a half for hours worked that week. For more information, contact a member of VeralDana's labor and employment team at VeralDana.com.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we have a national speaker and national author, Dr. Tracy Weiland. She's a prominent thought leader on the impact of technology on society, work, women's leadership, and careers. She's the author of a new book, Employed for Life, 21st Century Career Trends. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.